Newspapers have been known to go to great lengths to hide their story budgets. That's the all-important list of what's coming up in the next day's paper. One British paper, however, has begun to do the opposite in the last few months. They're making their list public so readers can weigh in on story decisions. Dan Roberts is the national news editor for The Guardian. He joins us from the offices of the paper in London. Dan, welcome.
Hi.
So what on earth possessed you to publish your story list?
We've been experimenting for a while in trying to get readers to help us report things, and we realized that the only way to really take that to a bigger scale was to tell them what we're already doing, because there's no point in just kind of giving them a blank sheet of paper and saying, what would you do? You have to kind of engage them in the process as we go along. We got a lot of good feedback, so we decided to keep it going, but actually we want to relaunch probably in the new year. And I think we are actually giving people stories that we haven't written about when we think they can help. So a good example, we did an investigation into the exploitation of interns, and rather than the normal process of doing the investigation and then opening the piece up for comments on the website and then seeing people's experiences, we flipped it and we said, right, in advance we're going to tell people we want to investigate this. Can you give us examples of perhaps how you've been exploited as an unpaid intern? And suggestions poured in, and then we did the reporting, we checked them out. The advantage of that was that you get a much better story. We had some brilliant examples that really opened people's minds just how bad the problem was. But also we had an audience that was already there waiting for us to tell them about it. So it ended up being the best read story of the week.
So talk more about how this experiment affected the way you made decisions about what to cover.
We are finding sometimes the editors have a particular sort of short-sightedness about an issue that the readers are much more fired up about. We had a good example when we were covering reforms to the National Health Service. We'd reported it extensively over the summer, but when the bill actually reached Parliament, we kind of switched off from it. And we got a lot of feedback from readers saying, no, we really want every spit and cough of the parliamentary debate. And so we responded to that. We set up live coverage for the two-day debate, put some reporting resource into it. And they were right. The parliamentary stage was much more important than we had acknowledged. And we got huge traffic on the stories, but also a lot of engagement in the comment threads under the stories.
What did this experiment teach you about your news judgment?
Well, I think we've got to recognize our strengths and weaknesses. I mean, I think our strengths are that as professional journalists, we can be dispassionate about things. And the positive side of it is that there's only a few of us, and it's a big world, and there's an awful lot of things going on. And actually, it's that wisdom of crowds thing that actually good ideas bubble up that you're not going to get through a dozen people sitting in a room or around a table chewing over that day's news.
Dan Roberts, he's the national news editor for London's Guardian newspaper. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News. David Beckham. When you hear that name, you probably think of one of today's greatest soccer players.
Can he bend it? Beckham! It's in the net! It's in the net! Beckham is going to try it over the halfway line, and he's going to hit an empty net! What a goal from David Beckham!
Beckham has played for some of the world's biggest teams, Manchester United, Real Madrid, and AC Milan. In 2007, he shocked the soccer world by signing a multi-year contract with Major League Soccer here in the U.S. The LA Galaxy signed the soccer hero for what was reported to be worth as much as $250 million. As that contract comes to an end and Beckham decides whether to stay or go, we wanted to talk about whether it was all worth it for the team, the fans, for Major League Soccer. Joining me now from our New York bureau is David Henry Sterry. He's a co-author of the book, The Glorious World Cup, A Fanatic's Guide. David, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thank you.
So just how big were the expectations for Beckham when he came to the U.S.?
Well, basically, they thought he was Jesus and Moses and possibly Buddha rolled into one. How's anybody going to live up to that? And the whole thing was so bizarre right from the beginning because it was this gigantic announcement, $250 million for David Beckham. And you saw it everywhere on the website every time you opened up your computer, $250 million. That total was completely fabricated. But in fact, the contract was, I think, $32 million. And before they even announced he was on the team, they sold 250,000 copies of his uniform. So they immediately started recouping that money. Beyond the money, it had enormous ramifications for Major League Soccer and soccer in America.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit more. First, say Major League Soccer. How did this affect the credibility of the league or how it's perceived compared to 5 years ago?
Well, It was a little bit like in the old NASL. You know, they've been trying to do this in America to make soccer important for decades and decades.
And the NASL was the North American Soccer League from the 1970s,
which brought in
Pele. Right?
Yes, and Beckenbauer, and the biggest. They had like an all-star team for the Cosmos. But that lent an instant credibility to the league, to that league, just as signing David Beckham did for the MLS. And then you saw Thierry Henry come in New York. They just bought Robbie Keane, who's a phenomenal top-line player. I mean, these guys are all at the end of their career, as is David Beckham. But he brings something that very few other people in any sport bring. How many athletes have had a movie named after them? Bend It Like Beckham. I mean, that sort of cultural cachet, it's hard to even put a price value on that.
Well, okay, now we know what the LA Galaxy has gotten out of this, and we know a little bit about what Beckham has gotten out of it. What about soccer fans?
Yeah, it really made soccer kind of sexy in America, which it has never been. But Beckham and Posh Spice, and all of a sudden he comes to America and he's hanging out with Will Smith and he's hanging out with Tom Cruise. And
right, because I mean, arguably, I want to just put in a word here for sexy soccer players, of which I think there are many, but
yes.
You're talking about a dose of Hollywood.
Exactly. No, I'm not talking about the actual men with their rippling abs, no, which there are plenty of, and God love them. But I'm talking about the idea of soccer. It just has never really caught on. The last World Cup, there was gigantic interest in America, an enormous amount of financial resources put behind that. But still, the MLS is not the United States soccer team. And the MLS has been growing slowly but surely. Now, a lot of the teams now have dedicated stadiums. And it gave that league a gigantic boost. It really did. Recently, Major League Soccer passed the NBA and the NHL in average attendance.
So what is the future for Major League Soccer in this country?
I think it's in a fantastic position to sort of solidify what they have now. We have about 2 years till the next World Cup. And the World Cup and MSL sort of feed each other. And with the frenzy that's going to come with the next World Cup, which is in Brazil, I think it's going to really help the MLS sort of solidify themselves. But I think if they can get a couple more really big name soccer players, it's going to be a tremendous spurt of growth for Major League Soccer and soccer in general in America.
David Henry Sterry, he's the co-author of The Glorious World Cup, A Fanatic's Guide. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
When Teresa Urrea was just a teenager living in Mexico, she was already being hailed as a saint.
In a Sonoran town near the coast, the Teresistas had gone mad with love. They'd begun by praying in their small Catholic church, crying out for Teresita to return. Someone had a bottle of her bath water, still smelling of roses, and when it splashed among them, they flung themselves into the aisles. They cried out in Hebrew and the forgotten tongues of angels. Pictures of Teresita appeared from under blouses and from mochilas, as if they were a visitation from heaven, as if she herself were in the pictures somehow.
That's Luis Alberto Urrea reading from his new novel. It's called Queen of America. The book picks up where his last novel, The Hummingbird's Daughter, left off. The year is 1893, and Teresa Urrea has been driven out of Mexico by the government into a new, rapidly modernizing America. The story is fiction, but Teresa Urrea was very real. In fact, she's author Luis Alberto Urrea's second cousin. And Luis Alberto Urrea joins me now from member station KUOW in Seattle. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Your new book is a sequel, though it stands alone. It's a sequel to your most recent novel called The Hummingbird's Daughter. Talk about the original inspiration for these books.
The original inspiration happened in Tijuana. I was born in Tijuana, raised back and forth between the U.S. and TJ, as we called it. And I had all these power ants, these kind of semi-frightening women who would tell us these outrageous stories. And one of the stories was about the aunt. You know, you have a yucky aunt who could heal the sick and could raise the dead, and she could fly. I think she can fly. So, you know, this aunt I thought was sort of a family myth until I discovered her in history books.
Throughout your childhood, you would always hear about this woman, Teresita. She was this great healer.
Yes.
What could she do?
She actually was, in the first part of her life, studying to be a traditional midwife and herbalist with a medicine woman in Sonora. And she had a terrible near-death experience at about 16. And when she came out of it, her body actually began to exude the scent of roses, which is a great old kind of Catholic saint affliction. And once that began, she developed the troubling ability to touch heal. This began this incredible siege of followers and believers and indigenous tribes that erupted into warfare and fire and madness.
Luis, your book starts with Teresita fleeing Mexico with her father, Tomas. Explain why they are on the run.
When she became the saint of Cabora, and the tribes in the north of Mexico began realizing her powers or believing in her powers, I guess I leave it up to you to decide, they flocked to her. And the Mexican government was already involved in a very savage war with the Apache Nation. And they had begun a genocidal extermination of the Yaqui people. And when she got her powers and began to preach a kind of liberation and self-worth and self-determination, the Mexican government panicked, and they were going to be executed. And Porfirio Diaz realized that if they executed her, indigenous warfare would erupt. So Mexico decided, well, gosh, we can eliminate a whole class problem by just shipping those folks north. And once she got to the United States, her influence did not diminish but began to grow. And I think Diaz and his regime repented and began sending assassins into the United States.
On both sides of the border, admirers came to see her, all kinds of people. When they finally met her, what did they ask for?
The majority of them wanted some sort of healing, but I have many accounts of people who simply would come to be with her. There's a great story about a man who was on his deathbed, and his sons brought him, and she spent time with him holding hands and laughing. And then she said, I'm done. And the sons started this outcry that she's a false healer. My father's dying. She should have cured him. And he stopped them. And he said, no, I'm dying. But the reason I came here was to go in peace. And now I can die because she's assured me everything's all right. So she was part psychologist, part midwife, part healer. I often tell audiences out here on tour that Queen of America is in some ways my Lady Gaga book, right? Because she came here and became a pop star. And I don't think she was ready for American stardom, which was just revving up along with the Industrial Revolution.
I'm speaking with Luis Alberto Urrea about his new novel. It's called Queen of America. In the book, Teresa heals people all the time, of course. But when she cures one little boy, his name is Jamie in the book, it changes the course of the rest of her life. What happened?
Yes, it really does. Some Americans stepped in. They were well off, and they had a son who was suffering from what I suspect was spinal meningitis. But she actually healed this little boy, and it so astonished this family. They were from the San Francisco area, that they had a friend whose daughter was ill, and they asked her, please come with us to San Jose. And so she went. And once she went to this San Jose world that she could not have imagined, that was when Teresita finally and almost fully left the embrace of her people. When she'd left Mexico, she was torn from her tribe. And then she went to San Jose, and she was slowly overcome by the Anglo world.
And towards the end of her life, she was surrounded by people who didn't really know the kind of impact she had on thousands of people, right?
They knew she had influence and power, but they didn't particularly care or believe it. And she had made a vow to her God that she would not profit from her gift or curse. I don't know that being a saint is a gift to anybody, right? It may have been a curse. And this consortium formed of great capitalists, and they sat her down and they drew up a contract. So she'd given herself to this consortium that began making money hand over fist.
They were collecting money from people who were seeking her out, almost like a carnival sideshow.
It was a bit of a Barnum show, yeah. I mean, they were charging people to come in and get a healing, selling her image and getting her endorsement, getting her face in clinics for a fee so that the Mexican people would go to those clinics and because she gave the endorsement.
Luis, do you think that this woman, Teresa Urrea, ever regretted coming to America?
I think she regretted all of it, honestly. I mean, you know, she didn't ask for this to happen. This stuff came upon her like an avalanche, and her friends were killed. Massacres happened in her name. And in her later life, when she got to this far extreme of power and fame and misery and loneliness and realized what she really wanted was just to be a person and just to be a woman, just to be a mother, just to return to her home. And she tried with all her might to stop the machine and go back and live a normal life, which I'm happy to say she was able to do for a period anyway.
That's Luis Alberto Urrea. He's the author of the new novel, Queen of America. Luis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
From NPR News, it's Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz.
Peter Piper. Peck to pick
up. In a lot of ways, Nick Hanauer is just like you and me. He spoke to us from Seattle this past week, which is where he lives.
You know, it's not bad. It's cold but clear, which in Seattle at this time of year is a miracle.
And he grew up working for the family business.
It's a manufacturing business, a business that makes bed pillows and down comforters.
What kind of pillows?
All kinds.
He has a wife, two kids, a boy and a girl, ages 11 and 9.
You know, we go out to eat occasionally. As most American families do, I buy a few pair of pants a year, as most American men do. My wife and I, we own three cars. The only really expensive thing in our family budget, frankly, is private air travel.
Private air travel, as in Nick Hanauer's private jet. Do you use that for family travel too, or do you just fly commercial, like for vacations?
No, I haven't been on a commercial airplane in a very long time.
Nick Hanauer is a venture capitalist. A couple years ago, he was one of the first big investors in a little startup you may have heard of, Amazon.com. Roughly how much do you think you're worth today?
Not a billion, but a lot more than a dollar.
Now, recently, Nick wrote an opinion column for Bloomberg News, and this was his plea to the government. Please tax me more. And he insists it's all about self-interest.
I reject the idea that I'm advocating higher taxes for myself and other wealthy people because I'm a good person or because I love you. Let me just be very clear. I do not love you. I value you as a potential customer. And we have rigged the economic system in a way to destroy my customer base.
Which, he says, is the middle class. Now, for the top income earners, the official tax rate in America is now 35%. If you earn $380,000 or more a year, that is, in theory, what you pay in federal income taxes. And in fact, many taxpayers in this category do pay that rate, but many do not. That's our cover story today, taxing the rich, who pays, who doesn't, and what's a fair share anyway. In a moment, more from Nick Hanauer, and later, former Congressional Budget Office Director Douglas Holtz Eakin on why he thinks soaking the rich is bad economics. But first to investigative reporter Jesse Drucker. He writes for Bloomberg, and he recently published a story about how, for the most part, the richest people in America pay nothing close to 35%.
You know, Steve Jobs at Apple, or Larry Page, or Eric Schmidt, or Sergey Brin at Google, these are men who are extremely wealthy. You know, Brin and Page have net worths in the billions of dollars. They get salaries of a dollar a year.
A dollar a year. That's because the wealthiest Americans make their money, from stocks and investments. And those are only taxed at a rate of 15%, and only when you sell them. And since 2003, thanks to a rule change from the IRS, the richest investors have been able to do even more.
Yeah, I was at Lehman at the time. People said, wow, this is terrific.
That's Bob Willens. He runs his own tax and accounting firm. But for years, he was a partner at Lehman Brothers, where one of his jobs was to cut deals with the firm's wealthiest clients that had a side benefit. It was a way to avoid paying taxes. It's called a variable prepaid forward contract.
Variable. It's not as scary as it sounds. It's an agreement that an owner of stock enters into typically with an investment bank.
Basically, I agree to give you my stock at a certain point in the future for getting cash now.
That's Jesse Drucker with Bloomberg again. He says the IRS doesn't necessarily consider that a sale of stocks, even though the bank may pay that investor hundreds of millions of dollars to temporarily own his shares. And it allows the investor to avoid paying capital gains taxes, which right now, as I mentioned, are 15%. Again, here's tax lawyer Bob Willens.
So I wouldn't say it's a bending of the rules. It's probably a bending of the spirit of the rules. You know, a lot of times I've found the rules themselves that could be questioned.
In recent years, the IRS has been less likely to let people bend the spirit of the rules as easily. A couple years ago, a billionaire investor named Billy Joe Red McCombs made one of those deals. He earned $259 million out of it. But because it wasn't officially a sale of stock, he didn't report that $259 million as income.
The thing that's interesting about Mr. McCombs, and, you know, not to single him out, because this is something that a lot of very wealthy people do, is that in a year when Red McCombs got $259 million in cash from an investment bank to spend however he wanted, that $259 million did not show up anywhere on his tax return that year. In other words, very wealthy people are pretty regularly figuring out ways to cash out appreciated shares and appreciated real estate in ways that do not show up on tax returns. And the result of that is that the 17% rate that we hear often cited by Warren Buffett that he and other folks in his class pay is probably much too high. In reality, there are many folks paying effective tax rates that are much lower.
Which brings us back to Nick Hanauer.
I make an eight-figure income annually.
The multimillionaire venture capitalist we heard from earlier.
And my tax rate this year was about 11%.
How is that?
The reason for that is this. Most Americans think that the tax rate on the wealthy is 35%, but this is absolutely not true. If you're a small business person earning $350,000 a year, your tax rate is 35%.
Right.
But if you were a hedge fund guy or an incredibly rich person like me, all of your income is from capital gains or dividends or tax-free municipal bonds or what have you. And these things are taxed at much lower rates.
Now, Nick Hanauer is someone who might be called a job creator. He invests in companies that hire people. And some economists and most Republican lawmakers argue that if you increase taxes on these people, the result would be devastating for the economy. Here's Speaker of the House John Boehner.
Tax hikes continue to hold back job creators around our country.
But Nick Hanauer says the economy is like an ecosystem and that its lifeblood is the spending power of the middle class, not people like him. In fact, he says he's not even a job creator.
Business people do two things with their time fundamentally. The first is that they try to create sales, right? Revenue, key to business. But the other thing they devote their time to equally is cost containment. That is to say, how to not create jobs. Because the fewer jobs you can create for the revenue you create, the more profit you make. The only time that businesses create jobs is when middle-class consumers essentially put a gun to our heads in the form of orders for products that we cannot make ourselves. And then we hire people and create jobs.
And his basic argument is this: make the wealthiest Americans pay their fair share in order to give the middle class some tax relief. The question is, what's a fair share? Here's conservative economist Douglas Holtz-Eakin.
Fairness is in the eye of the beholder. Hmm. The wealthy now pay the dominant fraction of income taxes, and they fund the dominant fraction of our government, but they pay a lower fraction of their income in taxes. And so fairness is either measured by how much of your income goes away or how much of the government you pay. You get a different answer.
Right, because what? The top 1% of income earners in America pay roughly—
The top 5% pay 60% of income taxes. In the end, taxing is not a way to make any economy stronger. It's a necessary cost of having government services. We value those services. We want national defense. We want basic infrastructure. So I think it's misleading to say, hey, we're going to use the tax policy to somehow make the economy grow better. It's actually a price, not a benefit.
Say in a year's time from now, the Bush-era tax cuts are not extended, mm-hmm. and the rate goes up to about 39% for the wealthiest mm-hmm. Americans. What is that going to do to the economy, in your view? What would actually happen?
if we let the entire Bush tax cut sunset, where the bulk of the money is actually to the middle and lower classes, that's going to be a big shock to the economy. $130 billion a year, $1.3 trillion pretty quickly. I think that's a strong negative impact. If you somehow do what the administration has suggested and only do the high end.
The high end, right.
It's a smaller hit, but that's never really been the argument, in my view. The argument should be, if we want to raise money from the wealthy, let's ask how we're going to raise it. The least effective way to raise it is to raise marginal tax rates because, as you know, you can get financial instruments to defer that tax. You can rearrange your affairs and avoid it legally. Let's do tax reform. That's what the Bowles-Simpson Commission said. That's what all the fiscal commissions have said is if you want more revenue, you have to talk tax reform because how you get it from the rich matters.
And perhaps what matters most is how you define income. Your wages are easy. Everything else is more complicated. Again, here's Bloomberg investigative reporter Jesse Drucker.
You know, the top 1% control something like 34-35% of the net worth or the net wealth in this country, but topped out at about 20% of the income. And so that shows you right there that the income inequality that we're talking about based on tax return data from the IRS isn't really giving a full indication of the real level of inequality.
Nick Hanauer, the venture capitalist who wants to pay more taxes, says the system as it is set up now is actually bad for the economy. It's simply widening the gap between the richest and the middle class. And he points out that if the average American family still had the same share of income they earned in 1980, they would have $13,000 more to spend a year.
If Jeff Bezos and I had started Amazon.com in a poverty-stricken corner of Africa, there would have been no job creation because there would be no people to buy the stuff from Amazon.com. The difference here is the American middle class, which is, by every measure, the most extraordinary economic achievement in the history of the world. And there is only one of those. And it is the font of both innovation and of demand, not just for the American economy, but for the world's economy. And in that sense, it's incredibly precious.
That's Nick Hanauer. He's written about taxes and income distribution in the book, The Gardens of Democracy. It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
Britain is out of it and will remain out of it. Other countries are in it and are having to make radical changes, including giving up sovereignty to try and make it work.
British Prime Minister David Cameron yesterday, after his country chose to remain outside a new landmark agreement that will further integrate the European economy. It's one of the stories James Fallows of The Atlantic is following, and he joins me now, as he does most Saturdays, for a look behind the headlines. Jim, hi.
Hello, Guy. Welcome back.
Thanks, indeed. This treaty, it's designed to rescue the euro, but also to force all of the signatories, I guess, to be more fiscally disciplined. Britain is out. Quite possibly, Jim, more isolated from Europe than at any other time in the post-World War II period.
I think so. And this is actually a quite dramatic climax, or at least episode, in what's really been the saga of Britain's post-World War II or even post-imperial choice about whether in the long run it was going to basically be a European power allied with France and Germany and all its other traditional neighborhood rivals and partners, or fundamentally an Atlanticist partner of being connected with the United States for all the reasons they had been allied over the years. And I think we've seen, of course, the Atlanticist emphasis from the time of Churchill and Thatcher and Tony Blair on, but this is a time when I think even the British are reflecting on, is this too stark a choice they have made in rejecting where the rest of Europe is going? I think they can't quite foresee what all the consequences will be.
And we would assume that the consequences will be a really strong European economic integration, more so than exists now.
Yes, because the problem that this latest agreement was designed to solve is that over the last 20 years, the Europeans have gone halfway to some kind of economic and fiscal union. They had a common unit of currency across 17 countries, but they didn't have any way really to combine fiscal policy across those countries. So you have the spectacle that's been so dramatic of the Germans and the French feeling that they were responsible for decisions they couldn't affect in Greece and Italy and Portugal and elsewhere. So the step towards some kind of larger pan-European actual decision decision-making is what the rest of the Europeans are going through now and what Britain very much did not want to be part of.
Let's turn to domestic news and politics. We'll hear from Don Gagne, who is in Iowa, in a moment. We'll hear an update from him. Where Newt Gingrich is now the clear leader of the PAC there. He has been called the ideas man. Is he changing the tenor of the debate?
I think he actually has, and in a positive way. I still remain in the skeptical camp about whether Newt Gingrich will end up as the nominee against President Obama next year, but I think he's already had at least one measurably positive impact on the course of the presidential debate, which is that with all of his prolixity in ideas, he has either encouraged or forced the president to have a clearer statement of what his own ideas are. And so this speech last week in Kansas, in Osawatomie, Kansas, where Theodore Roosevelt had famously given his new nationalism speech a century ago, the president made a more coherent case for his view of government involvement in America's economic future than he had been forced to do before because the campaigning so far had been more sort of strictly negative. So the ideas man, for better or worse, Newt Gingrich, I think has evoked some ideas from the president.
He's driving that.
Yes, I think so, because until this point, you could say that the campaigning was purely negative within the Republican primary and against the Democratic administration, too, where the Republicans were sort of competing with each other for closer and closer fealty to the sort of the right wing part of the Republican Party, and just saying they were more and more outraged at what the administration was doing. And so I think that Gingrich has a way of having an idea every minute or two, and this has made the president match him in a better way than he's done before.
That's James Fallows. He's national correspondent for The Atlantic. You can find his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Guy.